The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Morris Williams, and it is my privilege to welcome you for another exciting event in the lecture series as part of the Free Library of Philadelphia. I would encourage you to consider making a financial commitment or gift to the Free Library of Philadelphia as part of your year-end gifts, because the library is open to all citizens in Philadelphia, and it is free, and so it needs the support of the public in order to provide all of the auxiliary services ranging from the after-school activities so that the library plays an extremely important role in our community. Tonight, we are blessed to have with us Dr. H.W. Brands. I encourage you to buy his new book, The Zealot and the Emancipator. I have read it. It is extremely insightful and brings two different people together. And he probably, in his comments, will talk about a bridge that exists between the two men. If you buy the book, you'll see information about Dr. Brands, but what you won't find out is that he graduated from Stanford. He has a master's in mathematics, in addition to having earned his PhD at the University of Texas at Austin. Another item that you may not know is that he taught at Texas A&M for, I think, 16 or 17 years. And so you may want to ask him to contrast and compare Texas A&M and the University of Texas and who he cheers for when they are in athletic competition. Another interesting insight about Dr. Brands, it is that while he is known for his coverage and writing, he's written 30 books ranging from Benjamin Franklin. I think one of his most interesting books was his book on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, from the perspective of the title, Traitor to His Class. But he did his PhD work on the foreign policy of Dwight Eisenhower, so that you may want to explore his perspective with regard to foreign policy. And just one other comment before I welcome Dr. Brands. Is that he has some strong views relative to the Constitution and the Founding Fathers with regard to original intent. And of course, with the recent discussion of the Supreme Court, three new justices being appointed this year, original intent has become part of the American conversation. And you may want to ask Dr. Brands for his views on original intent. But most importantly, I wish that we could all stand and applaud. Dr. Brands is an outstanding speaker, and I know that we are going to have an extraordinary evening. Dr. Brands, welcome.
Thank you, Morris. Thank you for that very kind introduction. And I guess I'll thank you for setting me up for those questions on very controversial subjects, but I'd be delighted to talk about those in anything. Anyhow, so I am delighted to be back, if only virtually, at the Free Library. I would like to add my applause for the work that the Free Library does and what public libraries do. I think that I can say that historically, they have been the avenue of individual advancement for thousands and thousands of people over the years, people who didn't have access to education, but found access to knowledge through libraries. And I can tell you that the most pleasurable moments I spent as a kid were my Saturday mornings going to my local branch of the Multnomah County Public Library in Portland. And I was just thrilled when, for some reason, I guess the librarian thought that I deserved waiving the limit for how many books a kid could take out, because I was of an age where you could only take out 3 or 4. And they said, oh, I'm going to treat you as an adult. You can take out 10. And this was just fantastic. And I would go back to the stacks and I'd get 10 books and I'd go home and I'd devour them. And so anyway, so please do contribute to the work of the Free Library and all public libraries, because they really deserve our support. Okay, so my subject for tonight is a subject that in some ways I have been thinking about and talking about for almost as long as I've been in the history business. I started my career as a historian, as a teacher, and I taught high school for 9 years before I started teaching college. But I've been thinking about John Brown and Abraham Lincoln and the events that they took part in and the issues that they wrestled with. And I have been talking about these two individuals to my students. I teach at the University of Texas. I make a point of teaching introductory students, which means essentially freshmen and sophomores and the odd senior who didn't get around to fulfilling his or her requirement until the last semester. And it requires me to think about big subjects. When I teach specialty courses to graduate students, even to upper division undergraduates, then you can zero in and get into fine detail on something. But when you teach the introductory courses, you have to frame things broadly. And you have to learn to summarize. You have to learn to, oh, in my case, because I'm teaching what amounts to a required course. And at the beginning of every semester, I ask the students, please be candid. Tell me how many of you are in this course because you have to be. And it's the nature of the course that 95% of the students raise their hand. So I feel that I'm kind of obliged. I take it as a challenge to try to draw them in and make them realize that this history stuff could be pretty interesting. So that's partly background. Another thing is that the longer I teach history, the longer I think about history, the more I conclude that the fundamental questions of history are questions that get at human nature, that get at the very basic sort of moral issues of how we live together, how humans get along, what makes us do what we do. And so there is a question that has occurred to me as I teach American history, but it's actually one that is drawn from my own personal experience. I was born a little bit too young to ride bus rides, be any of the Freedom Riders, or to march on behalf of civil rights. I was born in 1953, but I was old enough to get in on the tail end of the Vietnam War, or more precisely, to get in on the controversy surrounding the tail end of the Vietnam War. And a question that I had to deal with, just as everybody in the United States had to deal with, but some with a finer point than others, is what are we going to do about this war? Should we continue to support South Vietnam? Is this war a good war? Is this war a bad war? Is this a war we ought to support? Is this a war we ought to oppose? And it occurred to me then, and over the years, it just occurred to me again and again, that there is a fundamental moral question that everyone has to deal with in one form or another sooner or later. And actually, we deal with them in, if you have a long life, in many cases. But the question boils down to this: what does the good person do in the face of evil? What does the honest citizen of the United States do when he or she is convinced that the American government is engaged in some great injustice? What do you do? What's your obligation? What should you expect of yourself? What should you expect of others? And in the context of the Vietnam War, there were a lot of people who thought by the 1970s the war was immoral. So what do you do about it? And I disagreed with the premises of the war by then. So I was willing to go as far as to march, to take part in protests. But I knew people who thought that's not enough. A protest isn't going to get anybody's attention. A protest isn't going to bring the war to an end. We have to take stronger action. And I knew people who, well, were willing to countenance the use of violence, tossing a Molotov cocktail. into a Defense Department lab, that sort of thing. That's really going to get the attention. That's going to cause this, it's going to bring this war to a grinding halt. Well, that's not what brought the war to a grinding halt. But nonetheless, that was an attitude that was adopted by people that I knew. As I say, I wasn't willing to go that far. I was willing to march in protest of the war, but I wouldn't go that far. This question, what do you do when your country, when your government is doing wrong, is going wrong, was something that really came to a head in the middle of the 19th century over the issue of slavery, which brings me to John Brown and Abraham Lincoln. I chose to write about these two, and I will confess that I couldn't simply write about Lincoln, because Lincoln has been written about and written about and written about, and I needed to bring some new angle on Lincoln. And I was a little bit surprised to discover, at least to my knowledge, that no one else has actually juxtaposed John Brown and Abraham Lincoln in a single volume, the way that I did. And I brought them together because I wanted to pose this question. What does the good person do? In this case, what does the good man do when his country is engaged in a great evil? Now, it's important for my purposes, for the purposes of my sort of philosophical investigation into this, that the two men, John Brown and Abraham Lincoln, agreed on the immorality, on the evil of slavery. It wouldn't have done me any good for my broader investigation if they disagreed, because if they disagreed, then they would choose different courses because they disagreed. No, they needed to agree that slavery was evil. But they disagreed. They needed to agree that slavery is evil. They disagreed, though, on what to do about it. Now, this question of slavery as evil, it might seem like the most obvious thing in the world to someone living in the year 2020. But I have to point out historically that this was not always so. In fact, one of the reasons that the issues that I describe in the book came to a head when they did was that the founding fathers, the people who wrote the Constitution, who signed the Declaration of Independence, they weren't so sure that slavery was this overriding evil. Now, it is the case that nearly every one of those founders, including the slaveholders among them, thought slavery was wrong or was evil in some respect. And most of them hoped and expected that slavery would go away. But the slaveholders, at least in one fact, most people in the United States, not just slaveholders, considered slavery to be in the category of necessary evils. You couldn't run the Southern economy without slaves. This was the thinking at the time. And slavery is not a good thing. It's bad for the slaves. It's bad for the slaveholders because it develops sort of tyrannical autocratic tendencies in them. It makes them despise manual labor. It undermines the virtues the republic requires of its citizens. So it's a bad deal. But they thought it was going away because slavery, by the time the Constitution got around to being written, slavery had already been ended in Pennsylvania, and it was on the way out in most of the other northern states. Why? Why was this so? Was it that Northerners were seized by a fit of morality? No. It was, well, with the exception of some Pennsylvania Quakers who had been opposed to slavery on moral grounds for a long time, but they were considered real outliers by nearly everybody. No, in fact, the reason that slavery was ended in the North was that the Northern economy had evolved in a way that rendered slavery unprofitable and sometimes downright counterproductive. Or to put it another way, if you thought of slavery as a necessary evil in 1780, here's the necessary, here's the evil part. If you lived in Massachusetts or Connecticut or New York, by 1800, by 1810, the necessary part of slavery had gone down. Slavery was no longer necessary to the economy of those states. And therefore, you could focus, oh, the evil stands out because it's less necessary. And in 1789, when the Constitution was ratified, there was a general sense that this was going to happen in the rest of the country as well, in part because, well, in a place like Virginia, the value of slaves was declining. The principal crop that slaves cultivated was tobacco. And tobacco is really hard on the soil. And the returns to investment in Virginia were declining. And it looked as though slavery was on its way out in the South, just as it was, as it already had gone out in the North. Then something happened. Something changed. What happened was, well, two things happened. Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin, and new strains of cotton that could flourish in the soils of the Gulf Plains of the South were developed. And all of a sudden, forget about tobacco, we're gonna grow cotton. And cotton became this huge deal. And as cotton spread, and as far as anybody could tell at the time, slavery was necessary to the cultivation of cotton, the way cotton was cultivated in the American South. So again, in the balancing of necessary against evil, slavery became more necessary to the Southern planters, and therefore the evil was downplayed. Now, this balancing of necessary and evil, I think, is really critical. And I'll share with you an example that I use with my students, and that is that today most people look on war as this bad thing, but sometimes it's necessary. And so, and there aren't many warmongers around who like war for the sake of war. But on the other hand, there aren't very many pacifists around either who will say that war is never the answer to anything. So most of us today are in the category, we're sort of comparable to those folks in the 1780s and 90s who looked on slavery as a necessary evil. Now, it's not impossible. In fact, I dearly hope that, let's say in the next 50 years, 100 years, humanity figures out how to resolve its international disputes without war. I would love it if my great-grandchildren looked on me and my generation as a bunch of warmongers. What, you allowed wars to happen? How could you do such a thing? Because if they do, then war will no longer be necessary, and so the evils of war will come to the fore. Anyway, John Brown and Abraham Lincoln agreed that slavery was wrong. They disagreed on the tactics should be used to deal with slavery. John Brown believed he had a moral, even a religious calling to combat slavery by any means necessary. John Brown was born in 1800. He grew up in Ohio on near the Ohio River, the border between slave state Kentucky and free state Ohio. And he mingled with slaves. He had a playmate, this black kid who was a slave when John Brown was a boy. And John Brown remembered one day when they were playing, and they seemed to get along fine and all was well, until this white man, who turned out to be the black kid's owner, came up and started beating the black kid over the head and shoulders. And John Brown said, "What's going on here?" And he said, he remembered in later years that this was his first inkling that there was something really wrong about slavery. But it took the murder of an abolitionist editor named Elijah Lovejoy in 1837 to cause Brown to dedicate his life to battling slavery. He stood up in his church in Hudson, Ohio, where he's living. And he said, "I devote my life hereafter to the battle against slavery. And I say this before the eyes of God and before the congregation here." John Brown took the pledge. He would fight slavery. And John Brown's fight against slavery escalated over time. Until by the 1850s, John Brown was leading paramilitary groups in Kansas Territory, which had become a battleground between pro-slavery forces and anti-slavery forces. Why a battleground? Kansas Territory was part of the Louisiana Purchase, which by the Compromise of 1820, at least the northern part of the Louisiana Purchase, had been declared by the Compromise of 1820 off limits to slavery forever. But Stephen Douglas, senator from Illinois, had pushed through Congress a bill called the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which repealed that part of the Missouri Compromise and opened Kansas potentially to slavery under the principle of popular sovereignty. Seemed quite innocuous, seemed what you'd expect of democracy. Let people who support slavery go to Kansas, let people who oppose slavery go to Kansas, and when Kansas has enough people to warrant a constitution and statehood, let them write a constitution. And then they can decide, do you want that constitution to allow or to forbid slavery? Again, democracy in action. Well, that's what Stephen Douglas said. What happened was that there developed this competition, turned out to be a violent competition, between the pro-slavery side and the anti-slavery side. And John Brown joined on the anti-slavery side. And he went to Kansas to wage battle against the forces of slavery, but not just battle. Following some attacks by pro-slavery forces on anti-slavery communities, Lawrence, Kansas being one, John Brown believed that the slave power, the pro-slavery settlers and movement, needed to be taught a lesson. So John Brown led a small band of followers, including a couple of his adult sons, to a hamlet on the banks of Pottawatomie Creek in 1856. And John Brown and his followers dragged five pro-slavery settlers out of their beds and brutally murdered them, hacked them to pieces with broadswords. The point was to send a message to other pro-slavery settlers. If you come to Kansas thinking that you can impose slavery on Kansas, this could happen to you. John Brown became notorious for this. He was wanted by federal authorities in Kansas Territory. It was a federally administered territory. But he managed to wander around the country for the next 3 years. Because, well, this was in the days before convenient photography, so there were no photographs of John Brown. There were written descriptions, but he cut his hair short and grew out his beard, changed his name, and he could pass himself off as somebody else. And he wandered the country, including to the Northeast, raising money for an even bigger attack on slavery. This one was going to be to go to the heart of the slave system. As John Brown said, I'm going to take my battle to Africa, to the slave region itself. So John Brown organized, orchestrated, carried out an attack on a federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. The point of attacking the arsenal was to seize weapons there and to distribute the weapons among slaves in the vicinity of Harper's Ferry. The slaves would then use these weapons to rise up against their slave masters and to achieve their freedom. And the example of this successful slave uprising would shake the foundations of slavery throughout the South. Other slaves would rise up against their masters and they would achieve their freedom. This was John Brown's goal. Well, it didn't get very far. John Brown launched his raid. In fact, before he launched his raid, he tried to talk Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, one of the most famous abolitionists in the country in 1859. A former slave himself, and so he was living testament to how a black man could become as well educated, become as articulate, become as accomplished as any white person, if just given the opportunity. So John Brown thinks, boy, it'd be great if I could get Frederick Douglass to go along with this, because here's one of the most celebrated abolitionists in the country. And furthermore, he's a black man, he's a former slave. So this will lend credibility to my project. But Douglass says, no, I'm not gonna do it. Douglass acknowledged, you know, I'm a writer, not a fighter. But he also didn't join because he understood that John Brown was about to launch a suicide mission. Frederick Douglass understood something John Brown did not. John Brown was so committed to the emancipation of slaves that he assumed that the slaves themselves would be at least as committed to their own emancipation. And maybe, but there was a different calculation going on. John Brown had decided that he was willing to give up his life for the freedom of others, if it came to that. And he sort of assumed that slaves would be willing to risk their own lives for their freedom. Turned out that almost no slaves in the area joined John Brown, and those who did so kind of reluctantly because they never heard of this guy. And they said, what's he trying to do? He's trying to start this war. He's going to get us all killed. And so they didn't join. John Brown learned that getting into Harper's Ferry was easier than getting out of Harper's Ferry. He could get in because nobody was expecting an attack. But once John Brown and his band seized the arsenal, in doing so, killed a couple of people, awakened the townsfolk, brought out the militia, who immediately pinned John Brown and his men down. And there they were stuck for the next day and a half, until they were finally captured in an assault, and they were arrested, and they were put on trial. John Brown was tried for treason against Virginia and the murder of those people who were killed in the raid. So this is John Brown. John Brown has decided that slavery is so evil that the battle against slavery can take any form, including lethal violence. That's John Brown. Abraham Lincoln, meanwhile, Abraham Lincoln yielded nothing to John Brown in conviction that slavery was wrong. Abraham Lincoln was just as convinced as John Brown was that slavery was wrong. But Abraham Lincoln thought that John Brown was going about ending slavery in just the wrong way. Not only was John Brown morally wrong, you don't murder somebody even in a good cause. You don't try to start a war even in a good cause. But it wasn't just that. It was that John Brown's tactics would be counterproductive, said Lincoln. John Brown thought that he was freeing slaves. His raid on Harper's Ferry didn't free any slaves. In fact, in the short term, it tightened the shackles on slaves all the more, because as soon as slaveholders heard that there was this guy out there who was trying to free their slaves, now they made sure that the slaves didn't, you know, go anywhere unsupervised, didn't meet alone, didn't have any of the very minor liberties that slaves sometimes had. So there was this crackdown of slavery right away. But furthermore, Abraham Lincoln was one of he was an heir of Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, of Henry Clay. He believed that slavery would end in the United States when Southern slaveholders were convinced that it was in their interest to end slavery. He believed that that's the way democracy worked. He looked at the fact that Northern states had freed their slaves, and he believed that the Southern states would do so too in time. He didn't know how long, but he also believed that even if they didn't choose this on their own, their right to own slaves, the right of Southern states to allow slavery within their borders, was guaranteed by the Constitution. And Lincoln absolutely revered the Constitution. He thought that the Constitution was the guarantor of American freedoms. Now, he acknowledged that freedom was not complete, and there were a lot of people who were more free than other people. But he thought that once the Constitution falls apart, once the Constitution is destroyed, then such freedoms as anybody enjoys will be at risk. So while John Brown took the position that the battle against slavery was more important than preserving the Constitution, in fact, other abolitionists like William Lloyd Garrison disdained the Constitution. William Lloyd Garrison burned his copy of the Constitution because the Constitution guaranteed the existence of slavery in the states that still wanted to have slavery. Abraham Lincoln took the opposite view. Abraham Lincoln believed that emancipation was important, but the Constitution was more important. So Abraham Lincoln shuddered when he heard of John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, because he thought, oh my gosh, this is simply going to make things worse. And then when the court in Virginia, West Virginia was then still part of Virginia, when the court of Virginia found John Brown guilty of treason against the Virginia Commonwealth and of murder and sentenced him to death. And when the sentence was carried out, and then John Brown was hailed as a martyr to the cause of freedom by Northern abolitionists, Lincoln shook his head even more. He thought, this is the worst thing to happen in this country for years. Oh, and the worst thing potentially to happen to my political future. Lincoln was running for president as a moderate, and he knew that John Brown, you know, murderous John Brown, warmongering John Brown, would be declared to be exactly what all Republicans were. Now, Lincoln said again and again, John Brown is not a Republican. Republicans are not abolitionists. I mean, some Republicans were abolitionists, but most of them weren't. Lincoln was not an abolitionist. The abolitionists believed emancipation now, emancipation more important than anything else. Lincoln was opposed to slavery. I'll call him an emancipationist, but he thought that that wasn't first and foremost. The first most important thing was holding the Union together, and Lincoln thought that John Brown made holding the Union together far more difficult, which indeed is exactly what happened. Because when Southerners saw that John Brown had been canonized by Northerners, then Southern slaveholders believed that their property interest in slavery and their very lives were at stake. They imagined, what if John Brown's raid had succeeded and slaves had taken up arms and came and, you know, killed them? That's, of course, that's what they'd have to do to get their freedom. So there's a direct line from John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry to the decision of seven Southern states initially, and then 11 eventually, to leave the Union, because they believed that slavery was simply no longer safe within the Union. So this is the position that Lincoln finds himself in. So, and between John Brown's raid and Southern secession is the election of Abraham Lincoln. That's the final trigger, because now the government has been taken over by the head of this anti-slavery party. And Lincoln himself, in a speech that came to be called the House Divided speech, he said, "A house divided itself cannot stand. This country cannot remain half slave and half free. It will become all one or all the other." And it was really clear that Lincoln thought that it should become all free, which meant that slavery was going to end. So the Southern states decide to leave the Union. And Lincoln has to make a choice. What do you do about it? I should point out that there were a lot of abolitionists who said, a lot of abolitionists, Lincoln was not an abolitionist, but there are a lot of abolitionists who said, let the South go. In fact, William Lloyd Garrison, again, he had been saying for years that the North ought to secede from the South. That way, Northerners would no longer have slavery on their conscience. They could wash their hands of this. It's a little bit ironic, because if the North seceded from the South, this wouldn't free any slaves. It wouldn't make a lot of slaves any better, but it would make Northern consciences feel better or something. Anyway. So the South secedes, and Lincoln has to decide what to do. And what he decides to do is to, well, first of all, warn the South, don't secede, because if you do, this means war. And then when the South did secede, it did mean war. Now, what does this have to do with slavery? Well, in Lincoln's view, nothing to do with slavery. In fact, Lincoln definitely did not go to war against the South to free the slaves. Lincoln made very clear, this is not a war about slavery. Now, he did this for two reasons. One is constitutional. He thought that, again, the federal government, the president of the United States, has no authority over slavery in Virginia and in Mississippi and Georgia and any Southern state. And so he didn't have the authority to wage war against slavery. But secondly, tactically, he knew this would be a really bad idea. The Civil War began with Southern shelling of Fort Sumter in the Charleston Harbor in South Carolina. And after that happened, Lincoln issued a call for volunteers. He wanted 75,000 volunteers. The Union Army was not large at that point, so he needs a bunch of people. And he issued the call for volunteers to defend the Union, not to free the slaves. And he knew that if he had said, okay, I want 75,000 volunteers to go free the slaves, nobody would have showed up. Maybe a few people would have showed up, a few John Brown wannabes, but almost nobody else. Because for most Northerners, slavery was not that big an issue. No, they would fight to preserve their country, the United States, but they wouldn't fight to free slaves. And so for the first couple of years of the war, Lincoln took the position that this is not a war about slavery. The abolitionist editor, Horace Greeley, put the question to him, and Lincoln responded. He said, my job is to save the Union. If I could save the Union by freeing all the slaves, I would do so. If I could save the Union by freeing none of the slaves, I would do that. If I could save the Union by freeing some of the slaves and leaving others in bondage, I would do that. My job is to save the Union. But eventually, Lincoln concluded that saving the Union required the Emancipation Proclamation, required freeing the slaves. And so Lincoln went to war to preserve the Union. You know, in the perennial question, was the Civil War about slavery, about states' rights? The irony is, for Lincoln, it was all about states' rights. At first, more precisely, his position that states did not have the right to leave the Union. But it had nothing to do with slavery to begin with. It ended up being about slavery. And so we have this sort of big irony of my story here that John Brown went to war to free the slaves. He wanted to start a war to free the slaves. He failed to start his war and he didn't free any slaves. Abraham Lincoln tried to avoid a war. And when the war came, it wasn't about freeing slaves. But he failed to avoid the war. In fact, he led the country into the worst war in American history. 700,000 people died in the Civil War. And as a side effect of from Lincoln's position, slavery ended. So there we have it. Now, actually, I'm afraid I've talked too long. I've said too much. There's a lot more in the book besides this, so you really want to read it. But I'm going to stop here and take questions that might have occurred to people. So, Andy, do we have questions?
We do. Thank you for that terrific presentation, Dr. Brands. There are a number of questions here. One gentleman asks, a fellow named Jim, mentions that he's a volunteer history teacher, enjoys your books. As Lincoln did not believe that blacks were equal to whites in their rights, had Lincoln lived, would he have pushed for the 14th and 15th Amendments?
Ah, this is a really good question. And it is one of the reasons that Lincoln's reputation is as high as it is among presidents. He's considered to be the greatest president. But it's in part nothing that he chose, but he was assassinated, which meant he didn't have to deal with the messy business of what does freedom mean. Abraham Lincoln actually took the position before the war and even during the war that, okay, we're going to get emancipation, but then I need to talk all the freed men and women into leaving the country and going to Africa or going somewhere else, because Lincoln could not envision, nobody could envision, nobody had an example of a successful biracial democracy. I mean, just being a democracy at all was really tough. There was the United States and about no place else. But to add in the resentments that had built up over the years on the issue of race, it was just beyond Lincoln. So Lincoln did not have to deal with that. And actually, I dealt with it as a historian in a book that I wrote on Ulysses Grant, because Grant was part of the emancipation. Of course, he was the commander of Union armies during the Civil War, but he also had to deal with it during Reconstruction. And it was just a whole lot harder. And had Lincoln lived, this is a question that's often put, would Lincoln have done any better at Reconstruction than, well, he would have done better than Andrew Johnson, his immediate successor. Anybody could have done better than Johnson. But better than Grant? I don't know. I think that if Lincoln had lived, his reputation would have wound up being much less than this, because in a fundamental way, the Civil War was the easy part. The Civil War allowed Lincoln to cut the Gordian knot of slavery, because during wartime, you use the tools of coercion. You make people agree with you, or more precisely, you make them do what you want them to do. They don't have to agree with you. Once the war is over, then you have to go back to the political tools of persuasion. And Southerners were not persuaded by the outcome of the war. They were not persuaded by the 13th Amendment that all of a sudden these black people who had been slaves in the South were now or ought to be their equals. And so it was predictable that Southern whites would do whatever they could to restore as much of the antebellum order as they could. Now, they couldn't bring back slavery. And in fact, they concluded that they didn't really want slavery anyway. But they certainly erected a new system of social hierarchy in which black people were forced to be at the bottom of the pyramid. So would Lincoln have done any better at this? I really doubt it. I think it was one where I'm surprised almost that Reconstruction lasted as long as it did. It lasted almost a decade in parts of the South. But then Northerners just finally decided, you know what? The fate of black people in the South is not the thing I want to spend all my time worrying about. We've had enough of war. We've had enough of reform. We're just going to go back to our own lives and let Southerners deal with the race issue as they're going to deal with it. And that was essentially a position the country took until the 1960s. So it clearly wasn't just Lincoln.
Gus asks, was there an event that changed Lincoln's mind on slavery, or was it a gradual evolution on Lincoln's part?
There was no single event that told Lincoln that, okay, I now have to free the slaves. It was a combination of things and the building up of certain influences and pressures over time. So one was the fact that the war was not going well for the Union at first. It's important to remember that the South looked like it was going to win the war until the summer of 1864. And Lincoln understood this. He understood it well enough that Lincoln fully expected to lose his campaign for re-election in 1864. And it was only a month before the election took place, when Sherman captured Atlanta, that it looked as though, hey, maybe Lincoln's going to get reelected. So Lincoln thought that I'm probably going to lose this war. And so he was moved toward what he previously considered desperate measures. And he really didn't want to make it a war about slavery for a couple of reasons. One, again, this whole question of constitutional authority, but the fact that central to Northern military strategy was holding on to the border states, the four states, Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, Missouri, that were slave states that remained part of the Union. If Lincoln declared war on slavery, then those states would have almost no choice but to join the Confederacy. And if Maryland left the Union, then the Union government would have to evacuate Washington, because Washington would have been pinned between Maryland and Virginia, both at that point in the Confederacy. And holding the country without those border states would have been very much more difficult. But as the war progressed, Lincoln realized, and he was persuaded of this by some of his generals, but also by Frederick Douglass, that, you know, one of the biggest resources that the South has going for it is the labor of its slaves. If you could weaken that labor force, then it would benefit the Union war effort. And one of the best ways you could weaken that effort, weaken the labor force, is to promise freedom to the slaves, because then they would be encouraged to flee the plantations. And it was really harder, much harder to keep them on the plantations when most of the white men of military age in the South were off fighting. So if slaves were promised freedom, then they could flee. The first thing that would happen is you would subtract that labor from the Southern side, from the Southern equation, and you would add it to the Northern side. Now, initially, it was thought that the freed slaves would come and simply provide support services for Union forces. But that was important because it would free up white people to go fight. But eventually, the African-Americans, the freed slaves, were allowed to fight themselves. And so it really changed the balance. But there was another aspect here that is underappreciated from a distance because it was really outside the United States. And that was the role of Britain in Lincoln's thinking. Because Britain was the hope of the Confederacy for succeeding in their drive for independence. They remembered, people who knew their history knew, that the American Revolution succeeded only after a foreign ally, France, came to the aid of these new United States. And the Confederate states were looking for their own foreign ally, namely Britain, which had close commercial ties to the Southern cotton planters. And in fact, Southerners assumed that the British would force to join them. And they boasted that King Cotton would force Britain onto the side of the South. But the British had made their own reckoning with slavery 30 years before. And they had become anti-slavery in policy and emotion. And they just couldn't make that jump to supporting the slave South. But as long as Lincoln was saying this is not a war about slavery, then the British government could say, well, it's a toss-up between these two. Neither one is against slavery, so we might as well choose the one that benefits us economically, and that's Britain. And so Lincoln needed to preempt that by saying, yes, indeed, it is a war against slavery. And when he did that, then Southern hopes, they just went away, because the South was not going to get this foreign ally that it needed. And without that ally, Southern hopes were doomed.
I think you may have answered this a little bit earlier, but Jacqueline asks, what if the Union would have allowed Southern states to leave? What would the country be like now? And are there books that speculate on this counterfactual notion?
Some people have written about it. Novelists have written about it. It's really hard for any historian to take the counterfactuals too far and then to take them very seriously. Because once you get beyond the realm of what actually happened, there are too many places where the road could diverge. But there were plenty of people who thought that even if Lincoln had said to the South, go in peace, that peace would not have lasted. And here's the thinking. So if the South is a separate country, then Southern slaves are no longer guaranteed as property by the U.S. Constitution. They're beyond the bounds of the U.S. Constitution. It was the Constitution that required Northerners to help send fugitive slaves back to their owners, because there's a clause of the Constitution that says a property has to return to its owners across state lines. But if the South is beyond the guarantees of the Constitution, then, as I said earlier, that Lincoln said that the Constitution guaranteed slavery in the Southern states. If the Southern states secede, they're no longer under the guarantees of the Constitution. Lincoln at that point could have declared war on slavery and done it in good conscience. But even if he hadn't, imagine that the Ohio River was a border not between just a slave state and a free state, but between a slave country and a free country. The reason for the existence of the Underground Railroad was that once slaves got out of Kentucky and crossed the Ohio River, they were not safe in Ohio. They had to get all the way to Canada, because the Constitution would say mandated a return. But if they're separate countries, then it would have been a whole lot easier to escape to freedom, and a lot more of them would have done it. And so the South certainly would have issued an ultimatum against the North. You have to return those slaves. And the North would say, forget it. And the South probably would have declared war on the North to prevent the escape of slaves. So there are plenty of people who predicted that if the South were allowed to secede, within 10 years, there would have been a war anyway. So the Civil War that starts in 1861 might have started in 1871, but the end result might have been, well, who knows what it would have been. This is why you don't carry these counterfactuals too far.
Another question, this one from Fran. Did Lincoln's view, and I think you've touched on this a bit as well, did Lincoln's view of the Constitution match that of the originalists and textualists or some other philosophy?
The doctrine of originalism didn't exist until fairly recently. And so people did not talk about originalism. They did discuss what the framers of the Constitution intended, but they always discussed it in terms that would support whatever position they were trying to defend. And so discussions of what the Constitution means almost never historically have started with what the Constitution actually meant, but what do I want the Constitution to mean? And then, because the people who make these arguments are lawyers, and lawyers have cases to argue, and they bring in the evidence that supports the argument. But Lincoln's position on the slavery, it was one where, it was understood that slaves were protected. And the right of Southern states to have slavery was protected. But Lincoln understood that the government that he took charge of in 1861 was a very different thing than envisioned by the framers of the Constitution. And, in the first place, the framers had no idea that there would be political parties. And political parties just leaped up immediately. The framers also had no idea that the United States would even still exist in the 1860s. And for Thomas Jefferson, for example, and other founders, it's important to keep in mind that the Constitution of the United States that we know about was America's second try at a constitution. And the first one lasted exactly 8 years, from 1781, when the Articles of Confederation were ratified, to 1789, when they were superseded by the Constitution that we now live under. And so the idea that a constitution was going to last 2-3 generations, boy, this was beyond the imagination of the framers. Thomas Jefferson himself thought that every generation ought to write its own constitution, that the past had no hold on the present, and the present had no obligation to the future. So every generation creates the government that it wants. What eventually happens is that, again, people who want to shrink the size of government, they look to the Constitution, they call themselves originalists, and they look to the Constitution because the Constitution was written with the expectation that the federal government would be really small, as it was. But most of even the originalists are not willing to give up things like an Air Force So the Constitution says that there should be an army and navy, but they hadn't invented airplanes. So you have to stretch things in any event. And so the things that even the originalists look at, nobody's an originalist fundamentalist. And the last thing that's worth thinking about is the Constitution was very controversial in its day. Which of the original interpretations of the Constitution are you going to follow? Are you going to follow Alexander Hamilton's idea that the presidency should be a presidency for life? And he hoped that when George Washington was elected, he would stay in office until he died in office. And that would establish this pattern. And so the American presidency would become like the papacy, where you get voted in and then God takes you and that's how your term ends. Well, George Washington had a different view. And so they were both originalists. They were both there at the Constitutional Convention, and they had diametrically opposed view of what this presidency was supposed to be about. So which of the original interpretations do you follow? And then, as at least as I see it, you decide ahead of time what you want the answer to be, and then you argue to that answer, citing certain of the framers to suit your conclusion.
And you would say then Lincoln was a constitutionalist?
Just to circle back to the original question. Lincoln took the position that the president could override the Constitution. He knew he was playing fast and loose with the Constitution with the Emancipation Proclamation, but he suspended the writ of habeas corpus during the war. He cracked down on an opposition press. And the argument that he made was, look, I'm trying to preserve the Constitution. If it requires waiving certain articles of the Constitution, certain sections of articles of the Constitution, I'm willing to do that. Better to do that than in the interest of preserving the letter of this particular section of this particular article if I let the whole Constitution itself fall down. So Lincoln was as selective as everybody is in interpreting the Constitution. And one of the reasons you can do this is the Constitution is just a sketch. And so you fill out that sketch the way you want.
Mary asks, where were slaves defined as property and how did the Constitution protect that?
Slavery is not, the word slavery is not in the Constitution. It doesn't appear until the 13th Amendment. They were considered property at the time of the Constitution. And so they were protected where property is protected. So the federal government cannot come in and seize somebody's property without due process. And so, and lastly, the Constitution is what political scientists call a positive charter, that the Constitution as originally understood, here we do get to the original idea, as originally understood, conveyed only those powers to the national government that were expressly stated. This is what the Ninth and Tenth Amendments are all about. That if it's not stated you can do it here, you can't do it. You're a state. So these rights are reserved either to the states or to the people. And because the states had slavery or not had slavery, it was understood that the right to consider human beings, the slaves, as property, that was up to the states. And so it was a matter of the interpretation of the Constitution, but also a widely understood practice. And there was nobody, even among the abolitionists, that took a constitutional position that says that the federal government can end slavery in Virginia or Georgia. That has to be up to the states. Now, between then and now, a lot of issues, a lot of aspects of life have simply become federalized. So, I'll point this out, that the civil rights legislation of the 1960s would have been unrecognizable to Abraham Lincoln. For the federal government to say that shopkeepers in Alabama cannot bar their shops to Black people, well, of course they can, Lincoln would have said. But things had changed by the 1960s. And so just as a matter of legislation, not by amending the Constitution, could the Civil Rights Acts of the 1960s been passed. But things change. And interpretations of the Constitution, interpretations of the law, interpretations of just what morality requires change over time.
And to that, I'm going to try to combine a few things here just because we're running out of time. But Barbara asks, says, thank you for the talk. Thinking about John Brown, can you talk about how violence is perceived when it is used to oppose slavery and racism versus the extreme violence that has been part of the system of slavery and the perpetuation of injustice even after a civil war? It seems we excuse nonviolence when convenient.
Okay, so John Brown took the position that violence is inherent in slavery and therefore violence is justified in opposing slavery. Okay, and it's a plausible argument. And it certainly convinced John Brown. It didn't convince Abraham Lincoln. And as I say, Abraham Lincoln thought it was counterproductive and it would simply make matters worse. Did it apply during the 1960s? So was violence justified in opposing Jim Crow laws in the South? Is violence justified today in opposing aspects of racism, of inequality that people don't like? People are going to make their own decisions on that. It's a separate question, but related. So is violence effective? And I think the secret of the success of the civil rights movement of the 1960s was that the leading lights of the civil rights movement eschewed violence. Their protest was nonviolent because Martin Luther King and other leaders of the civil rights movement understood that to change America, you had to change the laws. In the same way that Lincoln understood to change America then on slavery, you had to change the Constitution. This is a nation of laws. Protests can get you only so far. But you have to end up by persuading people. This is the distinction between coercion and persuasion that I mentioned earlier, and the difference between war and Reconstruction. And so if you believe in a nation of laws, then in the end, you have to persuade people. And it's my perception that people are rarely persuaded by being beaten over the head. They're rarely persuaded by even, you know, being yelled at. You have to convince people. And as important as Martin Luther King was to the civil rights movement, Lyndon Johnson was just as important because Lyndon Johnson knew how to persuade Congress to pass the laws that made this possible. Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, but he knew that it wouldn't stick once the war was over. And aside from the fact, it left slavery intact in those border states. He knew that slavery would end only when the Constitution was amended. And that's why in the same breath that he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, he said, and now we have to amend the Constitution. And those of you who watched the Steven Spielberg movie Lincoln, this is all about Lincoln's attempt to get the 13th Amendment through Congress before the war is over, because he knows his leverage is going to diminish as soon as the war has ended. And so in a democracy, I think evidence demonstrates that violent protest might serve a purpose, but if taken too far, it quickly becomes counterproductive. Now, it may very well be in an autocracy, violence is the only way of dealing with things. Maybe you have to overthrow the government, and maybe you have to kill a lot of people in doing so. I hope that we are not even close to that position in the United States today. And the country has lasted as long as it has because the one time when this was attempted during the Civil War, that was enough for most people. And ever after, everybody said, no, we have to avoid another one of these things.
Let's end on something that might be fun to answer. Joseph mentions that when he visits the Smithsonian American Museum, he's always mesmerized by the portrait of John Brown and the portrait of Lincoln leaning slightly forward, listening and acting actively and thinking. Can you talk about these portraits, if you know them?
Yeah, so they really do capture certain important aspects of the two men. One of my challenges as an author of a book about John Brown is to explain John Brown's magnetism. He drew people to him. He impressed people who disagreed with him violently on basic subjects. He won over his captors in Virginia because they were amazed that this guy was as honest as he appeared to be. He actually wasn't as honest as he seemed to be, but he seemed to be honest, but he seemed to be upright and convinced. And so he had a certain kind of personal magnetism. He caused people to join him in doing things that are simply horrible, that these people would not have done on their own. So the portrait of John Brown has this sort of magnetism, this fire radiating from him. And it conveys the artist's notion that, yeah, there was something there. With Lincoln, Lincoln was not an activist type. Lincoln was somebody who thought long and hard about these issues. And certainly on this question of slavery, Lincoln thought that violence, the violent magnetism of John Brown is not leading us in the right direction. We have to think this one through. And Lincoln thought very carefully. He chose his words carefully. He chose his actions carefully. So yeah, those two views of Brown and Lincoln really do juxtapose the two. And you know, now that it's mentioned, I guess, you could just look at those two portraits and then you don't have to read my book. But actually, I think you ought to read my book too.
Yeah, they're not mutually exclusive. Well, Bill Brands, thanks so much for a terrific talk. Next time, I hope we can get you back in real life. Well, this is real life at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Thanks again. Have a terrific night, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.